If you're enjoying this book, then I know you will love the exclusive stories on our premium feed. Follow the link in the show notes to try it free for 7 days and dive into more of your favorite sleepy stories. Good evening, and welcome to the Sleepy Bookshelf, where we put down our worries from the day and pick up a good book. I'm your host, Elizabeth. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight. This evening, we're continuing with Emma. But first, let's take a moment to prepare ourselves to rest. Raise your eyebrows as high as you can for 5 seconds. Relax and immediately feel a release of tension. Now, smile as wide as you can and hold that for another 5 seconds. Now relax and squeeze your eyes shut. Hold it for 5 seconds. And relax. Tilt your head comfortably back so you can look at the ceiling, stretching your neck and your chin. Hold that for 5 seconds. And relax as your neck sinks back into your pillow. Now hug your arms around yourself, and if you can, pull your legs in as tight as comfortable and hold it there. Now release and allow yourself a lovely big yawn as you relax into your comfortable position. Last time, Emma reflected on the awful proposal of love from Mr. Elton on Christmas Eve and was happily met the next morning by a thick settling of snow, enough to prevent the family from making it to the church for Christmas Day. When the weather finally thawed after a week, Isabella and her family departed, and a letter arrived from Mr. Elton. He apologized for departing Highbury himself without taking his personal leave of Mr. Woodhouse. He would be visiting friends in Bath and wouldn't return for a few weeks. Harriet had just recovered from her cold, and Emma made use of this time to tell her everything that had transpired. Mid-January came, and Frank Churchill sent his excuses for not making his visit. Mr. Knightley deemed it weak, while Emma defended the boy with Mrs. Weston's sentiment. We pick up tonight with Emma and Harriet taking a walk one morning. So just lie back and relax as I turn to the next pages of Emma. Volume 2, Chapter 1. Emma and Harriet had been walking together one morning, and in Emma's opinion had been talking enough of Mr. Elton for that day. She could not think that Harriet's solace or her own sins required more, and she was therefore industriously getting rid of the subject as they returned. But it burst out again when she thought she had succeeded. And after speaking some time of what the poor must suffer in winter, and receiving no other answer than a very plaintive, "Mr. Elton is so good to the poor," she found something else must be done. They were just approaching the house where lived Mrs. and Miss Bates. She determined to call upon them and seek safety in numbers. There was always sufficient reason for such an attention. Mrs. and Miss Bates loved to be called on, and she knew she was considered by the very few who presumed ever to see imperfection in her as rather negligent in that respect, and as not contributing what she ought to the stock of their scanty comforts. She had had many a hint from Mr. Knightley, and some from her own heart as to her deficiency, but none were equal to counteract the persuasion of its being very disagreeable, a waste of time, tiresome women, and all the horror of being in danger of falling in with the second rate and third rate of Highbury, who were calling on them forever, and therefore she seldom went near them. But now she made the sudden resolution of not passing their door without going in. Observing, as she proposed it to Harriet, that, as well as she could calculate, they were just now quite safe from any letter from Jane Fairfax. The house belonged to people in business. Mrs. and Miss Bates occupied the drawing-room floor, and there, in the very moderate-sized apartment, which was everything to them, the visitors were most cordially and even gratefully welcomed. The quiet, neat old lady, who with her knitting was seated in the warmest corner, wanting even to give up her place to Miss Woodhouse, and her more active, talking daughter, almost ready to overpower them with care and kindness, thanks for their visit, solicitude for their shoes, anxious inquiries after Mr. Woodhouse's health, cheerful communications about her mother's, and sweet cake from the buffet. Mrs. Cole had just been there, just called in for 10 minutes, and had been so good as to sit an hour with them, and she had taken a piece of cake and been so kind as to say she liked it very much, and therefore she hoped Miss Woodhouse and Miss Smith would do them the favour to eat a piece too. The mention of the Coles was sure to be followed by that of Mr. Elton. There was intimacy between them, and Mr. Cole had heard from Mr. Elton since his going away. Emma knew what was coming. They must have the letter over again, and settle how long he had been gone, and how much he was engaged in company, and what a favourite he was wherever he went, and how full the Master of Ceremonies ball had been. And she went through it very well, with all the interest and all the commendation that could be requisite, and always putting forward to prevent Harriet's being obliged to say a word. This she had been prepared for when she entered the house, but meant, having once talked of him handsomely over, to be no farther incommoded by any troublesome topic, and to wander at large amongst all the mistresses and misses of Highbury and their card parties. She had not been prepared to have Jane Fairfax succeed Mr. Elton, but he was actually hurried off by Miss Bates, and she jumped away from him at last, abruptly to the Coles, to usher in a letter from her niece. "Oh, yes, Mr. Elton, I understand, certainly as to dancing. Mrs. Cole was telling me that the dancing at the rooms at Bath was, Mrs. Cole was so kind as to come and sit some time with us, talking of Jane, for as soon as she came in, she began inquiring after her. Jane is so very great a favourite there. Whenever she is with us, Mrs. Cole does not know how to show her kindness enough. And I must say that Jane deserves it as much as anybody can. And so she began inquiring after her directly, saying, I know you cannot have heard from Jane lately because it is not her time for writing. And when I immediately said, but indeed we have, we had a letter this very morning, I do not know that I saw anybody more surprised. Have you, upon your honour, said she, well, that is quite unexpected. Do let me hear what she says. Emma's politeness was at hand directly, to say with smiling interest, have you heard from Miss Fairfax so lately? I'm extremely happy. I hope she is well. Thank you. You are so kind, replied the happily deceived aunt, while eagerly hunting for the letter. Oh, here it is. I was sure it could not be far off, but I had put my huswife upon it, you see, without being aware, so it was quite hid. But I had it in my hand so very lately that I was almost sure it must be on the table. I was reading it to Mrs. Cole, and since she went away, I was reading it again to my mother, for it is such a pleasure to her. A letter from Jane, that she can never hear it often enough, so I knew it could not be far off, and here it is, only just under my huswife. And since you are so kind as to wish to hear what she says, oh, but first of all, I really must, in justice to Jane, apologize for her writing so short a letter. Only 2 pages, you see, hardly 2, and in general she fills the whole paper and crosses half. My mother often wonders that I can make it out so well. So often, she says, when the letter is first opened, well, Hetty, now I think you will be put to it to make out all that checker work, don't you, ma'am? And then I tell her I'm sure she would contrive to make it out herself if she had nobody to do it for her. Every word of it. I'm sure she would pore over it till she had made out every word. And indeed, though my mother's eyes are not so good as they were, she can see amazingly well still, thank God, with the help of spectacles. It is such a blessing. My mothers are really very good indeed. Jane often says when she's here, I am sure, Grandmama, you must have had very strong eyes to see as you do, and so much fine work as you have done too. I only wish my eyes may last me as well. All this, spoken extremely fast, obliged Miss Bates to stop for a breath, and Emma said something very civil about the excellence of Miss Fairfax's handwriting. You are extremely kind, replied Miss Bates, highly gratified. You, who are such a judge and write so beautifully yourself. I'm sure there is nobody's praise that could give us so much pleasure as Miss Woodhouse's. My mother does not hear. She's a little deaf, you know. Ma'am, addressing her, do hear what Miss Woodhouse is so obliging to say about Jane's handwriting. And Emma had the advantage of hearing her own silly compliment repeated twice over before the good old lady could comprehend it. She was pondering in the meanwhile upon the possibility, without seeming very rude, of making her escape from Jane Fairfax's letter, and had almost resolved on hurrying away directly under some slight excuse, when Miss Bates turned to her again and seized her attention. My mother's deafness is very trifling, you see, just nothing at all. By only raising my voice and saying anything 2 or 3 times over, she is sure to hear.
But then she is used to my voice. But it is very remarkable that she should always hear Jane better than she does me. Jane speaks so distinct. However, she will not find her grandmama at all deafer than she was 2 years ago, which is saying a great deal at my mother's time of life. And it really is 2 full years, you know, since she was here. We never were so long without seeing her before. And as I was telling Mrs. Cole, we shall hardly know how to make of her now.
Are you expecting Miss Fairfax here soon?
Oh, yes, next week.
Indeed. That must be a very great pleasure.
Thank you. You are very kind. Yes, next week. Everybody is so surprised, and everybody says the same obliging things. I'm sure she will be as happy to see her friends at Highbury as they can be to see her. Yes, Friday or Saturday. She cannot say which, because Colonel Campbell will be wanting the carriage himself one of those days. So very good of them to send her the whole way. But they always do, you know. Oh yes, Friday or Saturday next. That is what she writes about. That is the reason of her writing out a rule, as we call it. For in the common course we should not have heard from her before next Tuesday or Wednesday.
Yes, so I imagined. I was afraid there could be little chance of my hearing anything of Miss Fairfax today.
So obliging of you. No, we should not have heard if it had not been for this particular circumstance of her being to come here so soon. My mother is so delighted, for she is to be 3 months with us at least. 3 months, she says. So positively as I'm going to have the pleasure of reading to you. The case is, you see, that the Campbells are going to Ireland. Mrs. Dixon has persuaded her father and mother to come over and see her directly. They had not intended to go over till the summer, but she is so impatient to see them again, for till she married last October, she was never away from them so much as a week. Which must make it very strange to be in different kingdoms. I was going to say, but however, different countries. And so she wrote a very urgent letter to her mother. Or father. I declare I do not know which it was. But we shall see presently in Jane's letter. Wrote in Mr. Dixon's name as well as her own, to press their coming over directly, and that they would give them the meeting in Dublin, and take them back to their country seat, Ballycraig. Beautiful place, I fancy. Jane has heard a great deal of its beauty from Mr. Dixon. I mean, I do not know that she ever heard about it from anybody else, but it was very natural, you know, that he should like to speak of his own place while he was paying his addresses. And as Jane used to be so very often walking out with them, for Colonel and Mrs. Campbell were very particular about their daughters not walking out often with only Mr. Dixon, for which I do not blame them at all. Of course she heard everything he might be telling Miss Campbell about his own home in Ireland, and I think she wrote us word that he had shown them some drawings of the place, views that he had taken himself. He's a most amiable, charming young man, I believe. Jane was quite longing to go to Ireland from his account of things.
At this moment, an ingenious and animating suspicion entering Emma's brain with regard to Jane Fairfax. This charming Mr. Dixon, and the not going to Ireland, she said, with the insidious design of farther discovery.
You must feel it very fortunate that Miss Fairfax should be allowed to come to you at such a time, considering the very particular friendship between her and Mrs. Dixon. You could hardly have expected her to be excused from accompanying Colonel and Mrs. Campbell.
Very true indeed. The very thing that we have always been rather afraid of, for we should not have liked to have her at such a distance from us for months together. and not be able to come if anything was to happen. But you see, everything turns out for the best. They want her and Mr. and Mrs. Dixon excessively to come over with Colonel and Mrs. Campbell. Quite depend upon it. Nothing can be more kind or pressing than their joint invitation, Jane says, as you will hear presently. Mr. Dixon does not seem in the least backward in any attention. He is a most charming young man. Ever since the service he rendered Jane at Weymouth, when they were out in that party on the water, and she, by the sudden whirling round of something or other among the sails, would have been dashed into the sea at once, and actually was all but gone, if he had not, with the greatest presence of mind, caught hold of her habit. I can never think of it without trembling. But ever since we had the history of that day, I have been so fond of Mr. Dixon. But in spite of all her friend's urgency and her only wish of seeing Ireland, Miss Fairfax prefers devoting the time to you and Mrs. Bates. Yes, entirely her own doing. Entirely her own choice. And Colonel and Mrs. Campbell think she does quite right. Just what they should recommend. And indeed, they particularly wish her to try her native air. She has not been quite so well as usual lately. Oh, I'm concerned to hear of it. I think they judge wisely. But Mrs. Dixon must be very much disappointed. Mrs. Dixon, I understand, has no remarkable degree of personal beauty, is not by any means to be compared with Miss Fairfax. Oh, no. You're very obliging to say such things, but certainly not. There is no comparison between them. Miss Campbell was always absolutely plain, but extremely elegant and amiable. Well, yes, that, of course. Jane caught a bad cold, poor things, so long ago as the 7th of November, as I am going to read to you, and has never been well since. A long time, is it not, for a cold to hang upon her? She never mentioned it before, because she would not so alarm us, just like her, so considerate. But, however, she is so far from well that her kind friends, the Campbells, think she had better come home and try an air that always agrees with her. And they have no doubt that 3 or 4 months at Highbury will entirely cure her. And it is certainly a great deal better that she should come here than go to Ireland if she is unwell. Nobody could nurse her as we should do. It appears to me the most desirable arrangement in the world. And so she is to come to us next Friday or Saturday. And the Campbells leave town in their way to Holyhead the Monday following, as she will find from Jane's letter. So sudden. You may guess, dear Miss Woodhouse, what a flurry it has thrown me in. If it were not for the drawback of her illness, but I am afraid we must expect to see her grown thin and looking very poorly. I must tell you what an unlucky thing happened to me as to that. I always make a point of reading Jane's letters through to myself first, before I read them aloud to my mother, you know, for fear of there being anything in them to distress her. Jane desired me to do it, so I always do, and so I begin today with my usual caution. But no sooner did I come to the mention of her being unwell than I burst out, quite frightened, with, "Oh, bless me, poor Jane is ill," which my mother, being on the watch, heard distinctly and was sadly alarmed of it. However, when I read on, I found it was not near so bad as I had fancied at first, and I make so light of it now to her that she does not think much about it. But I cannot imagine how I could be so off my guard. If Jane does not get well soon, we will call in Mr. Perry. The expense shall not be thought of, and though he is so liberal and so fond of Jane, that I dare say he would not mean to charge anything for attendance. He could not suffer it to be so, you know. He has a wife and family to maintain, and is not to be giving away his time. Well, now I have given you a hint of what Jane writes about. We will turn to her letter, and I am sure she tells her own story a great deal better than I can tell it for her.
I'm afraid we must be running away, said Emma, glancing at Harriet and beginning to rise.
My father will be expecting us. I had no intention. I thought I had no power of staying more than 5 minutes when I first entered the house. I merely called because I would not pass the door without inquiring after Mrs. Bates. But I've been so pleasantly detained. Now, however, we must wish you and Mrs. Bates good morning.
And not all that could be urged to detain her succeeded. She regained the street, happy in this, that though much had been forced on her against her will, though she had in fact heard the whole substance of Jane Fairfax's letter, she'd been able to escape the letter itself. Volume 2, Chapter 2. Jane Fairfax was an orphan, the only child of Mrs. Bates's youngest daughter. The marriage of Lieutenant Fairfax of a certain regiment of infantry and Miss Jane Bates had had its day of fame and pleasure, hope and interest, but nothing now remained of it save the melancholy remembrance of him dying in action abroad, of his widow sinking under consumption and grief soon afterwards, and this girl. By birth, she belonged to Highbury, and when at 3 years old, on losing her mother, she became the property, the charge, the consolation, the foundling of her grandmother and aunt. There seemed every probability of her being permanently fixed there, of her being taught only what very limited means could command, and growing up with no advantages of connection or improvement, to be engrafted on what nature had given her in a pleasing person, good understanding and warm-hearted, well-meaning relations. But the compassionate feelings of a friend of her father gave a change to her destiny. This was Colonel Campbell, who had very highly regarded Fairfax as an excellent officer and most deserving young man, and father had been indebted to him for such attentions during a severe camp fever as he believed had saved his life. These were claims which he did not learn to overlook, though some years passed away from the death of poor Fairfax before his own return to England put anything in his power. When he did return, he sought out the child and took notice of her. He was a married man with only one living child, a girl about Jane's age, and Jane became their guest, paying them long visits and growing a favourite with all. And before she was 9 years old, his daughter's great fondness of her and his own wish of being a real friend united to produce an offer from Colonel Campbell of undertaking the whole charge of her education. It was accepted, and from that period Jane had belonged to Colonel Campbell's family and had lived with them entirely, only visiting her grandmother from time to time. The plan was that she should be brought up for educating others. The very few £100 which she inherited from her father, making independence impossible. To provide for her otherwise was out of Colonel Campbell's power, for though his income, by pay and appointments, was handsome, his fortune was moderate,
and must be all his daughter's. But by giving her an education, he hoped to be supplying the means of respectable subsistence hereafter. Such was Jane Fairfax's history. She had fallen into good hands, known nothing but kindness from the Campbells, and been given an excellent education, living constantly with the right-minded and well-informed people. Her heart and understanding had received every advantage of discipline and culture. And Colonel Campbell's resistance being in London, every lighter talent had been done full justice to by the attendance of first-rate masters. Her disposition and abilities were equally worth of all that friendship could do. And at 18 or 19, she was, as far as such an early age can be qualified for the care of children, fully competent to the office of instruction herself. But she was too much beloved to be parted with. Neither father nor mother could promote, and the daughter could not endure it. The evil day was put off. It was easy to decide that she was still too young, and Jane remained with them, sharing as another daughter in all the rational pleasures of an elegant society and a judicious mixture of home and amusement, with only the drawbacks of the future, the sobering suggestions of her own good understanding to remind her that all this might soon be over. The affection of the whole family, the warm attachment of Miss Campbell in particular, was the more honourable to each party from the circumstance of Jane's decided superiority, both in beauty and acquirements. That nature had given it in feature could not be unseen by the young woman, nor could her higher powers of mind be unfelt by the parents. They continued together with unabated regard, however, till the marriage of Miss Campbell, who by that chance, that luck which so often defies anticipation in matrimonial affairs, giving attraction to what is moderate rather than to what is superior, engaged the affections of Mr. Dixon, a young man, rich and agreeable, almost as soon as they were acquainted, and was eligibly and happily settled while Jane Fairfax had yet her bread to earn. This event had very lately taken place, too lately for anything to be yet attempted by her less fortunate friend towards entering on her path of duty, though she had now reached the age which her own judgment had fixed on for beginning. She had long resolved that 21 should be the period. With the fortitude of a devoted novitiate, she had resolved at 21 to complete the sacrifice and retire from all the pleasures of life, of rational intercourse, equal society, peace and hope, to penance and mortification forever. The good sense of Colonel and Mrs. Campbell could not oppose such a resolution, though their feelings did. As long as they lived, no exertions would be necessary. Their home might be hers forever, and for their own comfort, they would have retained her wholly. This would be selfishness. What must be at last had better be soon. Perhaps they began to feel it might have been kinder and wiser to have resisted the temptation of any delay and spared her from a taste of such enjoyments of ease and leisure as must now be relinquished. Still, however, affection was glad to catch at any reasonable excuse for not hurrying on the wretched moment. She had never been quite well since the time of their daughter's marriage, and till she should have completely recovered her usual strength, they must forbid her engaging in duties, which, so far from being compatible with a weakened frame and varying spirits, seemed under the most favourable circumstances to require something more than human perfection of body and mind to be discharged with tolerable comfort. With regard to her not accompanying them to Ireland, her account to her aunt contained nothing but truth, though there might be some truths not told. It was her own choice to give them the time of their absence to Highbury, to spend perhaps her last months of perfect liberty with those kind relations to whom she was so very dear. And the Campbells, whatever might be their motive or motives, whether single or double or treble, gave the arrangement their ready sanction and said that they depended more on a few months spent in her native air for the recovery of her health than on anything else. Certain it was that she was to come, and that Highbury, instead of welcoming that perfect novelty which had been so long promised it, Mr. Frank Churchill must put up for the present with Jane Fairfax, who could bring only the freshness of a 2 years' absence. Emma was sorry to have to pay civilities to a person she did not like through 3 long months, to be always doing more than she wished and less than she ought. Why she did not like Jane Fairfax might be a difficult question to answer. Mr. Knightley had once told her it was because she saw in her the really accomplished young woman which she wanted to be thought herself. And though the accusation had been eagerly refuted at the time, there were moments of self-examination in which her conscience could not quite acquit her. But she could never get acquainted with her. She did not know how it was, but there was such a coldness and reserve, such apparent indifference whether she pleased or not. And then her aunt was such an eternal talker, and she was made such a fuss with by everybody. And it had always been imagined that they were to be so intimate because their ages were the same. Everybody had supposed they must be so fond of each other. These were her reasons. She had no better. It was a dislike so little just. Every imputed fault was so magnified by fancy. She never saw Jane Fairfax the first time after any considerable absence, without feeling that she had injured her. And now, when the due visit was paid, on her arrival, after a 2 years' interval, she was particularly struck with the very appearance and manners which for those 2 whole years she had been depreciating. Jane Fairfax was very elegant, remarkably elegant, and she had herself the highest value for elegance. Her height was pretty, just as almost everybody would think tall, and nobody could think very tall. Her figure, particularly graceful. Her size, a most becoming medium between fat and thin, though a slight appearance of ill health seemed to point out the likeliest evil of the two. Emma could not but feel all this. And then her face, her features. There was more beauty in them altogether than she had remembered. It was not regular, but it was a very pleasing beauty. Her eyes, a deep grey, with dark eyelashes and eyebrows, had never been denied their praise. But the skin, which she had been used to cavil at as wanting colour, had a clearness and delicacy which really needed no fuller bloom. It was a style of beauty of which elegance was the reigning character, and as such she must, in honour, by all her principles, admire it. Elegance, which whether of person or of mind, she saw so little in Highbury. There, not to be vulgar, was distinction and merit. In short, she sat, during the first visit, looking at James Fairfax with twofold complacency, the sense of pleasure and the sense of rendering justice, and was determining that she would dislike her no longer. When she took in her history indeed, her situation as well as her beauty, when she considered what all this elegance was destined to, what she was going to sink from, how she was going to live, it seemed impossible to feel anything but compassion and respect, especially if to every well-known particular entitling her to interest were added the highly probable circumstance of an attachment to Mr. Dixon, which she had so naturally started to herself. In that case, nothing could be more pitiable or more honourable than the sacrifices she had resolved on. Emma was very willing now to acquit her of having seduced Mr. Dixon's affections from his wife, or of anything mischievous which her imagination had suggested at first. If it were love, it might be simple, single, successless love on her side alone. She might have been unconsciously sucking in the sad poison while a sharer of his conversation with her friend. And from the best, the purest of motives, might now be denying herself this visit to Ireland and resolving to divide herself effectually from him and his connections by soon beginning her career of laborious duty. Upon the whole, Emma left her with such softened, charitable feelings as made her look around in walking home and lament that Highbury afforded no young man worthy of giving her independence, nobody that she could wish to scheme about for her. These were charming feelings, but not lasting. Before she had committed herself by any public profession of eternal friendship for Jane Fairfax, or done more towards a recantation of past prejudices and errors, than saying to Mr. Knightley, "She certainly is handsome. She's better than handsome." Jane had spent an entire evening at Hartfield with her grandmother and aunt, and everything was relapsing much into its usual state. Former provocations reappeared. The aunt was as tiresome as ever, more tiresome, because anxiety for her health was now added to the admiration of her powers, and they had to listen to the description of exactly how little bread and butter she ate for breakfast, how small a slice of mutton for dinner, as well as to see exhibitions of new caps and new work bags for her mother and herself. And Jane's offences rose again. They had music. Emma was obliged to play, and the thanks and praise which necessarily followed appeared to her an affectation of candour, an air of greatness, meaning only to show off in higher style her own very superior performance. She was, besides, which was the worst of all, so cold, so cautious. There was no getting at her real opinion. Wrapped up in a cloak of politeness, she seemed determined to hazard nothing. She was disgustingly, was suspiciously reserved. If anything could be more where all was most, she was more reserved on the subject of Weymouth and the Dixons than anything. She seemed bent on giving no real insight into Mr. Dixon's character, or her own value for his company, or opinion of the suitableness of the match. It was all general approbation and smoothness, nothing delineated or distinguished. It did her no service, however. Her caution was thrown away. Emma saw its artifice and returned to her first surmises. There probably was something more to conceal than her own preference. Mr. Dixon, perhaps, had been very near changing one friend for the other, or been fixed only to Miss Campbell for the sake of the future £12,000. The like reserve prevailed on other topics. She and Mr. Frank Churchill had been at Weymouth at the same time. It was known that they were a little acquainted, but not a syllable of real information could Emma procure as to what he truly was. Was he handsome? She believed he was reckoned a very fine young man. Was he agreeable? He was generally thought so. Did he appear a sensible young man, a young man of information? At a watering place or in a common London acquaintance, it was difficult to decide on such points. Manners were all that could be safely judged of under a much longer knowledge than they had yet of Mr. Churchill. She believed everybody found his manners pleasing. Emma could not forgive her.